Missing Justice is an investigative true crime podcast from CBS News that examines the death of Christy Woodenthigh. On the night she was killed, Christy's family rushed to the scene in the Northern Cheyenne region and found no officers, no sirens, and no sign of Christy. This 6-episode series takes you inside what really happened that night and how the issues in Christy's case connect to the larger missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Listen to Missing Justice on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
One year ago today, Ukrainians woke up to aerial attacks by Russian forces.
Since then, they've experienced fighting and occupation.
We had no electricity, no food, no heat supply, no mobile connection.
Me and my husband slept on the floor, and a Russian soldier also slept on the floor next to me.
I'm Marco Werman in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler in Kyiv, Ukraine. Today on The World, how people have experienced the past year in Ukraine
and in Russia.
Inundating the audience with this sense of hatred, really, towards the West and towards Ukraine.
Also, an opera singer offers solace and renewal.
Maybe somebody come here to forget, you know, for this 3-4 hours just to watch something beautiful.
Special coverage of the past year of war from Kyiv, Ukraine, just ahead on The World.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. at WAMU.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler, coming to you from Kyiv, Ukraine, on the anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion here.
1 year ago, at 6 a.m. Moscow time, Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke on Russian state TV, announcing what Russian officials call the special military operation.
Half hour later, explosions were heard across Ukraine.
Putin is the aggressor. Putin chose this war. And now he and his country will bear the consequences.
The next day, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky sent his first video message about the invasion, a video that many Ukrainians say galvanized the country.
Всім добрий вечір. Лідер фракції тут. Голова офісу президента тут.
Zelensky's message, I'm here and will continue to be here. In the early months, the focus was on defending Kyiv from a Russian military convoy some 40 miles long.
Yes! Yes!
After Kyiv was secured, Russian forces focused their attack on the south and east. The last Ukrainian soldiers defending Mariupol were captured in May.
Throughout the summer, Russia made gains on Ukrainian territory. Ukraine's counteroffensive gained momentum by the end of the summer.
By November, the war seemed to be turning in Ukraine's favor. Ukrainians celebrated the recapture of an important southern city, Kherson.
Throughout the year, President Zelensky repeatedly called on the West to send more powerful weapons. Today, Ukraine is commemorating the invasion of a year ago. In the historic center of Kyiv, where I'm standing, ceremonies have been held at the Wall of Remembrance and at St. Sophia's Cathedral, where President Zelensky awarded medals to soldiers.
A year after the invasion, the front line is a jagged half-circle that cuts through Ukraine's eastern and southern provinces. Both sides are dug in and trying to find an advantage. The intense fighting there is something that many cities farther west experienced when the invasion began last year.
In some of those cities, you can still see plenty of damage, and parts of the country once controlled by Russian forces have since been retaken by Ukrainian troops. Life in a lot of those places is starting to look something closer to normal. To get a sense of what that means, we traveled a few hours north toward Ukraine's border with Belarus.
Driving north from Kyiv, the signs of war start to be more visible. You pass by tank barriers that are piled up in the middle of the street, ready to be redeployed if necessary, and military checkpoints where guards check your documents.
Our first stop is the village of Lukashivka, with a pre-war population of about 350 people. When Russian forces occupied the village for most of March last year, they turned a beautiful old church on the edge of town into their headquarters.
Standing in the church, you can look up and see a hole about 20 feet in diameter in the brick ceiling. Birds flying by.
Виїхало багато. Ну і у нас будується тільки 5 домиків.
I meet Irina Terekova down the road in front of her house, which, like many on the street, has no roof and only partial walls.
A lot of people left, and many of them haven't returned yet. You can see, like here, we have only five houses that are being rebuilt.
Speaking through an interpreter, Terekova says she and her husband moved to this house before the invasion. They wanted the small-town atmosphere and space to garden. Now they're living with neighbors until temporary housing is built.
We're still going to live here, and it's going to go back to normal.
Across town, Irina Novikova meets me at the gate of her house with her dogs. She tells me she was forced to host 11 Russian soldiers here during the occupation.
So, yeah, me and my husband slept on the floor, and actually a Russian soldier also slept on the floor next to me. Only the dog between us separated us.
Those Russian soldiers are long gone, but Novikova says their presence made people here suspicious of her family. About 10 miles up the road from the village is Chernihiv, the provincial capital. While Lukashivka was occupied, the city was under siege. Vyacheslav Chaus is the regional governor here.
We had no electricity, no food, no heat supply, no mobile connection. The food was mostly sent in here by boats by Desna River. Most of the civilians of the Chernihiv were situated in the basements, in the shelters. We were fighting.
Just outside the city center, in a heavily bombed area, there's an apartment building that had a huge hole in the side last spring. Now it's being repaired. There's fresh cinder blocks and a crane that looks like it's mid-construction project. In the apartment building next door, Yuri and Nina Chomitsky have been busy trying to make their apartment livable again. New furniture, radiators.
Over here, where you can see this is all just fixed and repaired, all this was damaged. Bought a new closet, a new lighter, and new windows.
Out the new window, there's a crater across the street and heavy damage to a squat red pharmacy.
There was two bombs where you can see the woman who was going in the blue coat. 48 people died at once.
Those explosions also blew out the windows and interior doors here and made it look like a tornado tore through the couple's apartment. Nina says their twin daughters have moved abroad to Canada with the grandkids. Chomitsky says they talk every day, and the grandkids tell her they want to come home. Yuri shows me a picture of one of his granddaughters on his phone, a blonde in pink glasses and pigtails, giving her grandpa a bear hug. What's her name?
Veronica.
Veronica. Even with the apartment nearly fixed up, he tells me it will never feel normal here until the war is over. As we arrive at St. Catherine's Cathedral in Chernihiv, an air raid siren goes off. It's an imposing 18th century church with golden domes at the edge of the town square. Mykolai Apanasenko is one of the priests here.
Most of the people are coming here to pray for our warriors. They're defending us. And we're talking with the people and trying to tell them we have to forgive Russians, and people cannot do this.
That's because they've been through so much, the priest explains. Then he tells us that a funeral service is about to begin for a Ukrainian soldier killed in combat. Soldiers are carrying in right now a casket. Dozens of people just streamed in. Many are laying long-stem roses in the casket. This soldier's name was Mykola Hiroshenko. He enlisted to defend his home city as it was being surrounded by Russian forces. He was killed almost 500 miles away in an area where there's been fierce fighting since May. Out on the church steps in the bracing wind, his widow Svetlana tells me her husband was trying to save an injured comrade when he was mortally wounded.
Milivi,
He was very brave, she says.
Конечно, був патріот, справжній герой.
He was a patriot, a real hero.
Таких немає мужчин. Дуже шкода, що їм.
It's a pity that these men, these kind of people are dying, real men.
Дуже шкода, що іменно такі є, справжні мужчини.
It's a pity that his arms will not embrace me anymore. She turns in her black headkerchief to follow the casket to the cemetery. My husband is waiting for me, she says.
Inside Russia, it's difficult to say exactly what people understand about the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin's narrative is hammered home every day on state-run news outlets, and yet public opinion of the war is still varied. The World's Daniel Hoffman has our story.
In Russia these days, flip on the TV Monday through Friday, and you're likely to find something that sounds like this.
Ну, лідерів надо предупредить, пусть дома сидять.
По Києву тогда не приедут. Вот что нужно сделать.
Highly produced political talk shows on multiple TV channels serving up over-the-top warmongering.
It's not really aimed at informing people in a kind of logical way. And really, it's just about inundating the audience with this sense of hatred, really, towards the West and towards Ukraine, and appealing to their emotions.
Francis Scar, a journalist with BBC Monitoring, spends hours a day analyzing Russian state media.
It's just about inundating the audience with this sense of hatred, really, towards the West and towards Ukraine, and appealing to their emotions.
This programming is driven by hosts like Vladimir Solovyov. He's got a 3-hour political talk show that airs 5 nights a week.
He's a rabble-rouser. He shouts
формулировками разными, как дела, вести little, знаете, small talk.
Really trying to say that if you're not with Putin, you're against Russia, you're against your homeland, and you're a traitor.
But how much influence does this media messaging have with the Russian public? Independent polls say that about 2/3 of the nation gets its news from state TV.
When you speak to Russians, the kind of Russians who watch these shows, which is generally people who are middle-aged or older, they will repeat some of these talking points that they hear without really being able to explain what they mean. And I think that shows how these programs work on people.
Another thing impacting people's lives, though, is the Russian economy.
If we look at the economic data in Russia, last year was a year of economic contraction and recession. This year will likely be another one.
That's Rachel Ziemba. She's with the Center for New American Security, where she studies the economic impact of sanctions.
We have two things happening. We have revenues going down because of these sanctions measures and because of alternate supplies. And then we have imports have gone up. And we also have the cost of mobilization.
And mobilization means Russia sending tens of thousands of men to the front lines in Ukraine.
Every day, equipment is being destroyed and needs to be rebuilt. People's lives are being lost. People are being taken away from other parts of the economy to focus on the war effort.
Ziemba says wealthy Russians are feeling the economic pain, but it's even worse for those whose income depends on the state. Still, polls show that a majority of Russians do not blame their government. Denis Volkov is the director of the Levada Center, an independent polling and research organization based in Moscow.
When there was escalation around Ukraine, more than 60% were blaming the United States. It's not even Ukraine, it's the West, or like it is said, a collective West.
Volkov says the public does not share the same passion that those TV commentators display. On top of that, the political reality has suffocated free expression. Many people are even afraid to participate in public opinion polls.
We only get answers what people want to share. And by this, we are getting people's public attitudes. And of course, we don't get their private thoughts.
Volkov says there's a generational divide. Those over 40 tend to be more pro-government in their thinking.
Younger people tend not to support any fighting, any violence. Quite often they say, I could not understand how any violence can be justified.
And with the war in Ukraine showing no sign of coming to an end anytime soon, that could turn out to be a problem for the Kremlin. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
We'll hear Daniel's reporting from Odessa later this hour. Our special broadcast from Ukraine continues just ahead. You're listening to The World.
I'm Marco Werman in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler in the historic Mykhailivka Square in Kyiv, Ukraine.
This is The World. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine a year ago scrambled some global alliances, solidified others, and drove a deeper wedge between the U.S. and Russia.
Over the past year, Washington has committed more and more resources to Ukraine, military and financial, for the country's fight against Russia. President Biden went to Kyiv this week and declared once again that his administration is going to stand by Ukraine for as long as it takes. To get a sense of what that could mean, I spoke this week with veteran U.S. diplomat and Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman. Deputy Secretary of State Sherman, thank you for making the time to speak with us.
Good to be with you always.
The Biden White House says it will stand with Ukraine to the end and that Ukraine will decide what victory looks like. But you've studied this region carefully. How do you hope this war ends? Would it be returning Ukraine to 2021 borders or its 1991 borders even?
So I think what really needs to happen here is that Ukraine be a sovereign country, that it have territorial integrity, that it be Ukraine, that it be able to be prosperous and defend itself against any further attacks in the future. What that looks like, when that moment comes, is entirely up to Ukraine.
So preventing further attacks, would victory then mean permanently disabling the Russia that we know today?
I don't think this is about disabling Russia. We are not about regime change in Russia. Our fight is not with the Russian people. It is with Vladimir Putin and his unilateral decision to invade a sovereign country illegally, unprovoked, and premeditated, and to not only create a conflict, be an aggressor, but to commit crimes against humanity, as Secretary Blinken and Vice President Harris have said, just such extraordinary things from sexual assaults to abducting children, deporting them to Russia, and trying to make them into Russian children, separating them from their families. Things that I think every mom and dad listening to this can feel and be horrified by.
Well, precisely. I mean, Russia under Putin has shown great willingness to do this, and history suggests he might try it again. So, again, let me ask you, I mean, would victory mean permanently disabling Russia?
That's a decision for the Russian people to make. That's the whole point here, is that people should choose their own political future. You know, I think it's very interesting when the president gave his speech in Poland, he spoke about solidarity and hope and all that we in the world are doing, more than 50 countries around the world to support Ukraine. Putin, on the other hand, did a cut and paste job of previous statement, a shoddily put together series of really mistakes, misperceptions, and quite frankly, lies about what is going on. I feel for the Russian people because so many Russians are dying in a conflict that was not necessary at all. And mothers and fathers in Russia are receiving body bags of young men who never wanted to go to war.
Even more worry this week, as you know, in a State of the Nation address of Vladimir Putin announced Russia would suspend its membership in the New START Treaty. When you heard him say that, did you think, well, there's a leader who is done with arms control?
No, what I thought was that this was a terrible mistake, that it was unfortunate, it was irresponsible. No, I do not think it is the end of arms control. In fact, the Russians then went on to say that they were only suspending, that they would stick to the limits of New START, and that at an appropriate time, they would be open to rediscussing New START.
I mean, even at the height of the Cold War, I'm thinking of, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. President Kennedy and then leader of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, were exchanging letters. That's not happening now. How would you describe the lines of communication between President Biden and President Putin at this, frankly, dangerous moment?
I agree it's a dangerous moment. I think that our wonderful Ambassador Lynn Tracy in Moscow has channels of communication with the Kremlin. Obviously, President Biden, President Putin have not spoken recently, and I'm not sure what would come of that at this time.
So if China starts sending military support to Russia for its war in Ukraine, as Secretary of State Blinken revealed this past weekend, some evidence that the U.S. has, how would that change your calculus for how the war is likely to proceed?
The People's Republic of China has always stood up for the U.N. Charter. And if they stand up for the U.N. Charter, that means they believe in sovereignty, territorial integrity, and the right of countries to make and the people of countries to make their own choices. That's not what Vladimir Putin is doing. So I would hope that Xi Jinping would think very carefully about the choices he is making.
Deputy Secretary Sherman, one of your big worries must be the possibility of Congress turning off the flow of support to Ukraine and undercutting the president's promises. What would the White House do? I mean, you must be thinking about that scenario.
I think, you know, we saw both Democrat and Republican leadership at the Munich Security Conference last week speaking with solidarity with the Ukrainian people. Are there some individuals who think otherwise? There are, but a small minority, and really proud of the strong bipartisan group of members who went to the Munich Security Conference to show bipartisan solidarity for Ukraine.
What is your biggest worry about what might lie ahead? What keeps you awake at night?
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, I feel for the Ukrainian people. Every day they face a potential loss of civilian life because Vladimir Putin is losing on the battlefield. And so he has decided to commit crimes against humanity by taking out his anger against the civilian population. I think that the world stands with the people of Ukraine, and I am hopeful that there will be better times ahead. Having been to Kyiv, though, I will say the resilience, the courage of the Ukrainian people is awe-inspiring and really extraordinary.
Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, thank you so much for your time. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
My name is Polina Bondarenko, and I'm 21.
This week, we've been asking people here in Kyiv what a year of war has taught them about themselves. Here is some of what we heard.
Over the last year, I learned the really price of this life and of my relationship with my family. For sure, my habits were changed in case of our electricity problems, of all these things when you need to go to a shelter.
I'm Anatoly Blinkov and I'm 18 years old. Probably I would say I can be really peaceful with myself. I found harmony inside of me. I'm from Kherson, is the south side of Ukraine, but I had a grandma and she's kind of pro-Russian position, you know, and she moved to Russia and we don't really like this situation. We don't speak with her. It's like different points of view on this situation.
Роман Криницький, 32 роки.
I'm Roman Krunitsky, I'm 32. I learned that I no longer have any taboo about killing people. Thing is, I also fought back in 2014 in the Donbass, and now also I have an injury. I was injured in Solidar. So it's no longer a big deal for me, because they came to our land and they want to take it away from us.
We'll hear more from people about what the past year has taught them as our special broadcast from Kyiv, Ukraine, and Washington, D.C. continues ahead.
In a year marked by the horrors of war, the city of Bucha paid an especially high price.
Now the city is rebuilding, physically and psychologically.
For me, in general, Bucha is not only the symbol of Russian brutality. For me, Bucha is a very strong symbol of recovery.
That story is just ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in the heart of Kyiv, Ukraine, on a breezy day.
And I'm Marco Werman in Washington, D.C. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX.
Here in Ukraine, we've spoken to a woman who lost her husband to the war, a family that fled and has returned, and a man rebuilding his damaged home. They are individual stories that represent the experiences of an entire nation.
Another way to understand the scope of the war is to look at the numbers. Let's start with this one. A year ago, 160,000 was the number of Russian troops that had slowly gathered along Ukraine's border on the eve of the invasion. 196,000, the number of Ukrainian military personnel a year ago. Now that number stands at about 500,000.
Russia continued to introduce large numbers of troops into the theater.
1.3 million was the size of Russia's military at the start of the invasion. Then September, 300,000 additional Russian troops were mobilized.
Here's a headline from the New York Times. Russia facing, quote, staggering fatalities. Which
some war statistics have been mind-boggling. Up to 200,000 Russian soldiers killed. As many as 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died on the front lines.
An all-day barrage of Russian missiles striking mostly civilian targets throughout the country.
As for Ukrainian civilian casualties, the death toll is estimated to be as high as 9,000 people. More numbers on the high cost of war.
The announcement of over $3 billion in new military assistance to Ukraine, including
U.S. military assistance to Ukraine in the past year, nearly $25 billion. 8 million Ukrainians have been displaced inside their country. On the plus side, humanitarian aid agencies have reached 15.8 million people there with assistance.
These are the lucky ones, the weary people who have escaped Ukraine and arrived in Poland.
8 million is also the same number of people who left Ukraine for other countries.
Flights from Moscow to all visa-free destinations selling out quickly.
And as for Russians, between 260 and 400,000 of them have left their country since it invaded Ukraine last year.
Another window into the impact of war is the effect it has on mental health. Earlier this week, I went to the suburb of Bucha, outside of Kyiv, to focus on that. A year ago, that word, Bucha, meant a commuter city outside of Kyiv. After it was occupied by Russian forces last spring, the word Bucha became synonymous with atrocities and war crimes. During Russian occupation, the city had no electricity and no way to preserve the bodies of the dead. So residents buried their dead here in mass graves they dug themselves in the yard of St. Andrew's Church.
It's one of the most symbolic places here in Bucha. Just to describe, when you must do something with bodies of those who were killed during occupation.
Earlier this week, I met Natalia Zaretska at the site of those former mass graves. She's a military psychologist who specializes in trauma. Despite her work, she's relentlessly positive, even on a cold day with wind whipping wildly around.
So today's weather is like a symbol of the whole previous year. There is sun. In a moment, there is no sun completely. In a few moments, there is sun with clouds. Maybe in a sort of way, all our life during the previous year was something like this.
Zaretska has been counseling people in Bucha to help them recover from what they experienced here last winter. I asked her to describe what the residents went through.
Maybe this experience was of several stages. People earlier, a lot of them thought that even if Russians came, they will not harm civilian population or Russian-speaking population. And so the first was to face this new situation, and the second task was to find a way to survive in it, to make a decision to leave or to stay. Here in occupation, they were isolated, so when they understood the real situation, it was maybe the third level of shock, and maybe it was one of the most pressure. The fourth challenge was to find the way to recover, to rebuild the buildings if they were destroyed, to support one another, to find missing people, to identify those who were killed, to find the way to feed their family and to wait when electricity and water will come back, because during the months they were without electricity and without water. And maybe the fifth challenge was to understand that deoccupation doesn't mean coming back to the previous normal life.
So coming to terms with the fact that life after the occupation is never going to be the same as life before the occupation.
Even if this experience was very hard for them, they were very successful because they are alive after that hard challenges.
Is it potentially triggering, or is it healthy for people to come here and grieve at this mass grave?
For me, in general, Bucha is not only the symbol of Russian brutality. For me, Bucha is a very strong symbol of recovery. Even here, we understand that all bodies were picked up. Most of them were already identified. Those who are not yet, but we understand that they are in the process, all DNA. Every street is rebuilt now. And population knows that if they need psychological support, if they need psychological assistance, they can get it.
From the site of the former mass graves, Zaretska is eager to show me something different. We walk to a massive construction site where heavy equipment is moving piles of rubble.
Here we are in the place which is the symbol of Bucha recovering. It was a building supermarket were huge. It was completely destroying. But now you can see focusing on replacing, rebuilding. Life must continue.
Zaretska is clearly proud of how quickly Bucha is rebuilding its physical infrastructure. I ask her about the long-term impact on the community of the trauma people experienced here.
So we can talk now only about expectations. Basically, I understand very clearly that people are stronger. In any case, if you was facing the challenge and if you went through it, so you have a very important experience and you can use it in your future life. From professional point of view, one of the main principles of our post-isolation support is to convert experience into internal resource and to help person to use this internal resource for personal recovery and to rebuild their lives after being in every hard situation. So some people do need professional support to understand the value of their experience, even if that experience was very harm.
Natalia Zaretska, a military psychologist, helping residents of Bucha repair themselves as the city is rebuilt around them. And right after I said goodbye to Zaretska at that construction site, I met Yuri Kravitsky, who was walking out of a complex of apartment buildings that overlook it. He was having a pretty big day.
I bought an apartment here today. And the windows here and here.
He's pointing up at a modern high-rise.
Because I have a wife, and my wife said that I must do this because we have a little child.
Kravitsky's mood changes quickly when he recalls the invasion starting last year. His wife and infant evacuated to a safer city, and he enlisted in the army. He's wearing camo pants and walks with a limp. He says he was discharged after getting injured in Severodonetsk last summer.
At 9 of March, I go to army, and on 13 March, we go to Lviv, near Lviv. And we were bombed. Then one time bombed near Lysychansk and Severodonetsk. A lot of time. It's not big deal to have bombed. A very big deal when you help your brothers, which already dead or have big injuries. My English not so good, but I think you understand. And then army said that thank you, but you are already done all what you can.
Yuri Kravitsky, injured soldier, young dad, new apartment owner in Bucha, Ukraine. A snapshot of one man's life a year after Russia's full-scale invasion.
Odessa is Ukraine's busiest port, and that makes it a target for Russian forces. But the city on the Black Sea is also a center of cultural life in Ukraine. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports from Odessa.
Odessa has a reputation. Historically, it's known for its humor, culture, and music. In the early 1950s, the native Odessan singer Leonid Utyosov performed many songs about his hometown. This one's called By the Black Sea. On Deribasovska Street, there's a statue of Utyosov. It's a block away from Odessa's opera house. And these days, when you walk along these streets, this is what you hear. Russia's military has been targeting Ukraine's electric grid, and power outages happen all the time.
That's what Odessa sounds like whenever the electricity goes out. The entire city runs on generators. But inside the Odessa Opera, it sounds very different.
Запомніть ту марку.
The Odessa National Academic Opera and Ballet Theater is the formal name of this place, but at rehearsal, the conductor and most of the orchestra are dressed casually. As one of the musicians walks on stage, he's greeted with a special tune. The orchestra plays this number whenever it's someone's birthday. Backstage, I'm told that they only really play it for people who are well-liked. They're running through the Blue Danube by Johann Strauss, with the choir singing the original lyrics in German. Here, it's easy to forget that Ukraine is a country at war. Inside the walls of this elegant neo-Baroque building from the late 19th century, the conflict outside feels distant. Between songs, I speak with Lyudmila Sirhichuk. She's the opera's assistant director.
Odessa is a special city, and not only because I was born here.
Sirhichuk says Odessa is a special city, and I'm not just saying that because I was born here.
Наш театр – це серце Одеси, серце Одеси.
The opera house, she says, is really the heart of Odessa. And Sirhichuk says that as long as the heart keeps beating, that means the city is alive.
Для мене і для моєї родини це життя в Одесі.
Sirhichuk and her whole family live here. She says they were shocked when Russia invaded, but they never left the city. They've been here the whole time. The first few months of the war, people tell me, were the scariest.
На початку війни театр був закритий.
Клаус, yes.
This is Дмитро Павлюк. He's one of the singers here. He says that for the first 3 months after the invasion, the opera house shut down.
Починали ми не в театрі навіть, тому що театр ще не був готовий.
Павлюк says they continued to perform around Odessa, and even outdoors, at parks and city squares. They put on performances for Ukrainian troops and people displaced by the fighting. 3 months later, the opera house reopened.
На жаль, театр не може впустити більше людей, чим вміщує бомбосховище.
Павлюк says they couldn't allow the full audience back into the building. They were restricted by the number of people that could fit into the opera's bomb shelter.
Були таке, так, звичайно, спускалися на годину, 40, в нас було таке, що годину сиділи глядачі.
On one occasion, Павлюк says, the air raid siren went off during a performance. Everyone went down to the shelter, and they were down there for an hour, and after the siren ended, they returned to their seats to enjoy the rest of the opera. Vitaly Bili, another singer, tells me this is part of their new reality.
I just understood, you know, it's my job. I need to do it. And that's it. It's my occupation. And also, you know what, just we'll sit in home and waiting for what?
Bili says he feels lucky to be in Odessa, a part of Ukraine that's relatively safe. And he's thankful that he can still perform in front of live audiences, especially after the opera house had to shut down for part of last year.
Once you saw the audience come back and clap and enjoy the performances, what does that mean to you?
We are still in life. Our work is a need for somebody, you know, not just for us. I think it's just only maybe somebody come here to forget, you know, for this 3-4 hours, just to forget about this terrible what we have right now and to watch something beautiful, to listen beautiful music.
When I ask Bili about his hopes for the next year, he says these days he doesn't really plan that far ahead.
Not just me, maybe everybody here, just living today and tomorrow. It's okay, it's fine. Because we don't know what happened after tomorrow. Or maybe right now, sometime it's...
He snaps his fingers and says that's how quickly things can change, even in the heart of Odessa. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Odessa, Ukraine.
A Another perspective here on what the last year has taught Ukrainians.
I'm 21 years old, and I am Vadim Shandursky. Maybe the most critical thing that I learned for the time, the last year, is that you don't need to focus like on your next future. So you just need to stay like focused and be present in the moment and do not build the like crazy plans and get most pleasure as you can, no matter what the circumstances you are in. What's happening around is the war, which you always under the stress, and you just understand that in any moment the rocket can hit you anywhere you go. You cannot be like completely sure that you're safe. It's a world, so you cannot expect some stability here.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler at the Wall of Remembrance for fallen soldiers in the heart of Kyiv. Many Ukrainian soldiers have spent months in battle, occasionally going home for a small break. These soldiers move between two very different worlds. I spent time earlier this week with one soldier while he was here at home in Kyiv. It's Sunday afternoon, and Dima Nechvolod is in the chair at a barbershop in the suburban Kyiv neighborhood where he grew up. How does it feel getting your hair cut?
Yes, I feel fresh.
It's nice to do something non-military for a change, he says, switching to Ukrainian. He's getting a fade from a young hairdresser with a highlighter pink ponytail. Nechvolod is still wearing his uniform, but this is a world away from the DIY haircuts from fellow soldiers that he got during 6 months on the front lines.
Let's say it was acceptable, but the good thing is that you don't see yourself in the mirror too often, and also you wear a helmet, so it was fine.
Nechvolod is an architect by training, but for 7 years before the war, he worked as an outdoors guide. He's 36, with a bit of a baby face lingering beneath the beard he's getting trimmed. You look great.
Thank you. I feel very, very good. Yes.
All cleaned up. Nechvolod is a fourth-generation soldier. Outside the barbershop, he tells me he went straight to the conscription office with his younger brother on the first day of Russia's invasion a year ago.
Basically, it became clear that the war has come to my city. And it also became clear I had to act fast.
In a coffee shop nearby, Nechvolod tells me he started serving in Kyiv's territorial defenses. Then he went east to the Donbas and Kharkiv regions. In November, while he was out in the trenches, he learned that his unit's headquarters had been hit in an artillery attack.
I clearly remember when we came to our HQ and we saw that the building was completely destroyed, everything was gone.
A good friend, a medic from his neighborhood named Nikita, was gone too.
It was basically 2 weeks before all of us were supposed to go to Kyiv, and he died.
Nechvolod is on rotation in Kyiv now for some rest and training before heading back to the front. Before he got here in December, he says he mentally prepared himself for the shock of returning to civilian life in a relatively peaceful city. He stayed with his parents at the apartment where he grew up and took long walks through his old neighborhood. It was just regular stuff, like stopping for coffee.
But I clearly remember that this was the first time I took off my uniform, and the feeling of being just an average regular citizen was very overwhelming to walk around the city just a regular day.
The last time he was in Kyiv, Nechvolod remembers that there were pockmarks on some of the buildings.
I
was walking around my neighborhood and I could see the traces of war. And when I came back, half a year later, it was all gone. Everything was repaired. Everything was rebuilt. This is something which impressed me.
Dima's father is in his late 50s. Volodymyr Nechvolod served in the Soviet and then Ukrainian armies himself. He tried to sign up again last year, but says the military wouldn't take him. When his sons came home from the front, he says he noticed a change in them. They began to appreciate life more, he says, every moment. To illustrate, he points out the window to a drizzly gray morning in Kyiv. They see more color in this spring weather than we do, he says. Even like this, from the window of their apartment, they see something in the yard and they say how beautiful it is. That's something I don't notice in everyday life. Back in the barbershop, Dima Nechvalod says taking pleasure in the small things, going for walks, getting a coffee or a haircut, it reminds him there's something to hope for on the other side of this conflict.
Basically, it motivates in a way that there's something to look forward to, be done with the war, and come back to normal life.
And that life will start when he's finally able to change out of his uniform for good.
We've been hearing this hour how Ukrainians say they've changed since last year's invasion by Russia. Ivan Polk is 31. He's from Lviv in western Ukraine.
What I learned about myself in the last year, the war actually, the beginning of the war, I would say, like, underlined everything you have in your life. So things that were good got better. For example, I got married. And things that were not so good, or people that you were not in a so good relationship, you just broke up relationship with them, like any business, friendship, anything. Like, the war underlined you are on our side, on their side.
Every Thursday evening, the Kyiv nightclub Pepper hosts a concert to support the military. It's called Nashapku, or Pass the Hat. Last night's performance raised money for medical care for troops.
The vibe was Ukrainian roots music under the influence of jazz, thanks to the main act, singer-musician Anna Kanzerska.
This song called Thoughts, it's about hard thoughts. All Ukrainians have also these heavy thoughts about what it will be next, what I will do tomorrow. It's also close to everybody in these heavy times. Before all these things happening, sometimes people ask me, are you proud that you are Ukrainian? And on that time, I said that for me it's nothing special, maybe I don't care, okay, I'm Ukrainian and that's it. But something changed in me, so now I'm very proud that I'm Ukrainian. In hard times, it's like a test. You can see the high-quality people and low-quality people. So in Ukraine, I saw a lot of high-quality people. I'm proud to be the part of this. And now, when somebody will ask me, are you proud of that? Yes, I am.
Anna Kanzerska closes out our broadcast today. Our reporting on the war in Ukraine continues at theworld.org, where you can travel through an interactive timeline of the past year.
The World broadcasts from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, and thanks to WAMU for hosting us this week in Washington. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for tuning in for our special coverage from Kyiv, Ukraine.
This past year, listeners continued to show their unwavering support of the world. Together, we raised over $67,000. We're grateful to the following people that helped us reach our goal. Chris Vild, Celia Putnam Duffy, Catherine Schlager, Philip Jennings, Martha Tomasek, Cheryl and Dave Bolin, Juan Roa, Lawrence Reisner, Robert Brewer. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners around the world.